by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at Southwest Ankeny and NATO Parkway in Waterfront Park. Information at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Every year, a diverse and eclectic group of musicians and dancers come together for one night for a performance which celebrates and strengthens Portland's experimental music and performance arts scene, Untoward. Untoward is an annual benefit show for the Creative Music Guild, whose mission is to promote experimental improvised music by presenting concerts, workshops, and other events that bring together internationally recognized musicians with local performers. This year's lineup includes Grammys with Noah Bernstein and Dan Sutherland, Kayon Gaskin and Noelle Stiles, Dragging an Ox Through Water, Eternal Tapestry, and KBOO's 2013 Artist in Residence, Marissa Anderson. Untoward 2013 will take place this Saturday night, December 14th, at the Secret Society Ballroom, located at 116 Northeast Russell Street in Portland. Doors are at 8 and the show begins at 9. Your attendance will help support the work of the Creative Music Guild, promoting and fostering experimental artists in the Northwest for over 20 years. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Untoward 2013, this Saturday, December 14th at the Secret Society Ballroom. Every year, a diverse and eclectic group of musicians and dancers come together for one night for a performance which celebrates and strengthens Portland's experimental music and performance arts scene, Untoward. Untoward is an annual benefit show for the Creative Music Guild. This year's lineup includes Grammys with Noah Bernstein and Dan Sutherland, Kayon Gaskin and Noelle Stiles, Dragging an Ox Through Water, Eternal Tapestry, and KBOO's 2013 Artist in Residence, Marissa Anderson. Untoward 2013 will take place this Saturday night, December 14th, at the Secret Society Ballroom, located at 116 Northeast Russell Street in Portland. Doors are at 8 and the show begins at 9. Your attendance will help support the work of the Creative Music Guild. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Untoward 2013, this Saturday, December 14th, at the Secret Society Ballroom.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in Hillsboro, activists protest Omega Morgan's megaload shipments through Oregon to the Alberta tar sands.
Occupy Portland protesters get their day in court at the Multnomah County Courthouse.
And a grassroots organization in Michigan exposes a tar sands oil company's cover-up of their use of toxic chemicals in a cleanup operation.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 12th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. In early October, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that 50 people arrested during the fall 2011 Occupy Portland protests are entitled to jury trials. The prosecutor had tried to circumvent this basic right by downgrading the original criminal trespass charges to misdemeanor violations. The Occupy defendants were called to court today and required to declare their intended representation. KBOO's Joe Meyer attended the hearing and filed this report.
After re-winning their right to a trial by jury, Occupy Portland defendants were in court today to legally declare their representation. Here's the judge reviewing the history of the case.
Ms. Bidlock's case was the lead case, and that went up to, that was the state took a mandamus action. That went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has ruled in that case and in the Fuller case, which guided this court's decision, that all of the misdemeanors, reduced to violations that people are charged with, do qualify as criminal prosecutions under Article 1, Section 11, and will be to jury trials. The court's decision was limited to jury trials. However, right to court-appointed attorney also falls under Article 1, Section 11. I believe that you are also entitled to a court-appointed attorney. That ruling does not apply to any cases that were started as a violation and tried as a violation.
One of the pro bono attorneys asked the judge for clarification regarding rights to a timely trial and what they were all doing here anyway.
Spoken with prior counsel, when we had an agreement regarding the disposition of the case following the court's ruling on the pending motions for speedy trial, and I understood that we're here today to schedule those hearings, the motion for speedy trial.
Well, what we'll be doing is, first, for people who are basically anyone, you're entitled to a court-appointed attorney. You can proceed with your pro bono attorney. You can request a court-appointed attorney, or you can retain an attorney. So if you want to request a court-appointed attorney immediately after today's hearing, you can go to the Justice Center across the street, the 1100 block of the 3rd Avenue, fill in the paperwork to request a court-appointed attorney. One person wanted to waive their right to counsel. If you want to proceed pro se and waive your right to counsel, we can do that. I would just need to deal with that today, and we would need to go through a waiver process.
We can also just put it on the record, right? You have to have paperwork.
Yes.
You have to have paperwork, because I've represented myself in different cases, and I didn't have to have any paperwork.
Well, for violations, you don't have to, but when it's a criminal prosecution, as it is now, it has to be a written waiver.
Two of the Occupy Portland 50 are representing themselves. Here's the more voluble.
To me, choosing to represent yourself is a choice of autonomy and not edifying the system that, you know, is based upon, just people, you know, using words to dominate other people and control them, you know, because everything that all the indigenous genocides that happened have been legal, you know. And just like in, Germany, everything that they did to the Jews was legal. So, you know, it's not exactly as harsh, but it still is the same exact mechanisms in terms of the legal system, you know. So that's really why I'm here.
That's why you're representing yourself?
Exactly. That's exactly why I'm representing myself. I'm not going to let, I'm not going to edify, you know, these lawyers that want to come in here and try to make a name off of, you know, people protesting. And, you know, folks that are doing it for the good reasons, that's fine. But I don't want to. I want to do it on my own terms, you know, defending myself, you know, in court before, so. And I've won, so yeah. I'm not afraid.
You're not afraid.
And I'm not afraid. I'm not scared of these fools.
Well, if you go hunt a lion, though, you want to bring a guide. How come a lawyer is not a guide? Like, hunting a lion is a guide.
Yeah, I've been guided in some improper ways,
okay,
for sure, by lawyers. So, you know, I'll have conversations with folks and file my motions and, you know, make everything on the record and just, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I can say that I'm fighting, and I'm doing it on my own terms.
The next court date is scheduled for January 9th, and I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Activists protested the movement of megaload shipments to the Alberta tar sands today at the headquarters of Omega Morgan in Hillsboro. KBOO's Paul Rowland was there, and he filed this report.
And we'll be jolly friends forevermore.
Okay, hi all. We had this messenger meeting because we are concerned about the Omega Morgan's choice to ship tar sands equipment across eastern Oregon. This has happened without our consent and without the consent of the native tribes who live out there. We apologize for disrupting your meeting, and we demand to see the CEO so we can voice our concerns in person. As soon as we get that, we'll leave. Y'all can keep going with the projector and everything like that. Thanks.
Oh, there once was a man named Omega Morgan. He shipped megaloads on the road again. They rolled out and then got blocked again. Poor old Omega Morgan, begin again. There once was a man named Omega Morgan. He shipped megaloads on the road again. They rolled out and then got blocked again. Poor old Omega Morgan, begin again.
Mr. McCullough and employees of Omega Morgan, we have come here to voice our opposition to your company's transport of equipment bound for the Alberta tar sands through our eastern Oregon communities. Without any public consultation, Omega Morgan has chosen to ship three massive megaloads of tar sands equipment from the port of Umatilla through Pendleton and Ukiah, down into Mount Vernon and John Day, and then into our neighbors' backyards in Idaho and Montana. The permitting for these shipments were granted without public comment period and decided without consultation from the tribes whose territory is being trespassed, including the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla. We are here to tell you that you do not have the public's permission to move this equipment through Eastern Oregon. We are here to demand that you stop moving tar sands equipment immediately.
Woo! Woo!
The extraction of tar sands in Canada has become the largest and most destructive industrial project in the history of the world. It involves clear-cutting vast swaths of boreal forests, leaving poisoned soil, water, air, plants, and wildlife in its wake. Clearing forests for tar sands is now the second largest driver of deforestation in the world. Extraction has also left behind 67 square miles of toxic tailing ponds, which poison wildlife and local indigenous peoples. This has led to spikes in rare forms of cancer and is destroying the ecosystems that bind the people to their land and their cultural traditions of hunting, gathering, fishing, and drinking from local waters. That this continues despite massive indigenous resistance is an insult to the spirit of democracy, a violation of indigenous rights, and a testament to the legacy of colonialism. The Earth's climate is in chaos because we have cut down too many forests and burned too much fossil fuels. Both processes being driven forward with astonishing carelessness by every company that supports and profits from tar sand extraction. Climate chaos means droughts, floods, disease, famines, and superstorms. These kill at least 300,000 people annually, and that toll is expected to rise in the coming decades. The recent typhoon in the Philippines displaced over 500,000 people and left nearly 6,000 dead. Their country's leading representative to the COP19 climate negotiations, Nadarov Sanyo, is now on a hunger strike. It is immoral and socially unacceptable for companies to profit from tar sands extraction that devastates ecosystems and the people who rely on them. Your company has a choice in who it chooses as business partners. We will not stand by idly as our backyards are turned into industrial extraction corridors. We are not going to pay for the damage you intend to do to our roads, and none of us can pay for the damage that occurs when indigenous rights are trampled, water is systematically poisoned, and the Earth's atmosphere is dismantled. We want to be proud of our local businesses, to support them in their efforts to grow resilient, thriving, and sustainable local communities. That is precisely the reason we cannot ignore businesses that choose to harm our communities and trample indigenous rights. From Missoula to the Clearwater Valley, through sacred ancestral Umatilla lands, and to the cozy suburban offices of Hillsboro, we are here to send you a message. No more megaloads. Sincerely, Portland Rising Tide.
That was Paul Rowland reporting for KBOO News. The founder of the popular file-sharing website Pirate Bay has been put in solitary confinement in a Danish prison. Godfried Warg remains in solitary confinement after being extradited from Sweden to Denmark. Pirate Bay, founded in 2003, is considered to be the largest BitTorrent tracker in the world. Internet freedom advocates say that imprisoning the Pirate Bay founder is equivalent to putting the founders of Google in prison because some users post copyright content on YouTube. Gottfried's lawyer says he shouldn't be treated as a dangerous criminal because the only charge that could even be considered against him could be hacking, but Danish authorities have not actually charged him with any crime. Gottfried has already been acquitted of charges in Sweden after being extradited from Cambodia, but then Danish authorities demanded his extradition and immediately put him in solitary confinement when he arrived in the country. Julian Assange of WikiLeaks came out in support of the young man, describing him as a WikiLeaks consultant and political prisoner, and condemning his extradition to Sweden and then to Denmark on what he says are trumped-up charges.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Feature Story News, followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather forecast is overcast with a 30% chance of precipitation of some sort, a high of 44 degrees and a low of 35. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 60. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 32 CPM with a high of 58. Powell Butte measured 26 CPM with a high of 46. And Seaside, Oregon on the coast has 33 CPM with a high of 51. Sitka in Alaska has a radiation count of 37 counts per minute with spikes up to 52. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:17, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A, and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute, colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation? The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed, no say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing, too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
A bill passed last night in the Michigan State Legislature that will prevent insurance companies from providing coverage for abortion. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists stood in opposition to this law, which requires women to purchase separate insurance coverage to cover abortions they might have in the future. Since there wouldn't be an exception for rape, opponents are calling it rape insurance. If a non-sexually active person gets raped and an abortion is deemed necessary, then the victim will have to pay out of pocket for the procedure. State Senator Gretchen Whitmer spoke on the Senate floor in opposition to the bill.
As a legislator, a lawyer, a woman, and the mother of two girls, I think the fact that rape insurance is even being discussed by this body is repulsive, let alone the way it has been orchestrated and now shoved through the legislature. And for those of you who want to act aghast that I'd use a term like rape insurance to describe the proposal here in front of us, you should be even more offended that it's absolutely accurate description of what this proposal requires. This tells women that were raped and became pregnant that they should have thought ahead and bought special insurance for it. By moving forward on this initiative, Senate Republicans want to essentially require Michigan women to plan ahead and financially invest in health care coverage for potentially having their bodies violated and assaulted. Even worse, it would force parents to have similar and unthinkably terrible discussions about planning the same for their daughters. I've said it before and I will say it again. This is by far one of the most misogynistic proposals I've ever seen in the Michigan legislature. And I'm not the only one who knows that. Right to Life of Michigan has pushed this twice before, and two times before, two different Republican governors stood up and vetoed it with conviction. Just last year, we were dealing with the very same issue. And Governor Snyder, when he vetoed it, said, "I don't believe it's appropriate to tell a woman who becomes pregnant due to a rape that she needed to select elective insurance coverage." Apparently, by bringing this back up, you would disagree with him. You believe that women should be told they should have selected elective insurance coverage before they got raped. That is exactly what your yes vote here today means. Right to Life gathered around 300,000 signatures. It might sound a lot, but it only makes up 4% of our voting population. They had to use blatant lies to even convince people that this was something worthy of signing. They told the public this was about preventing Obamacare from paying for abortions. Bull. This is about interfering with private insurance carriers and preventing them from covering needed health care for women. Right to Life told the public their goal was to put this issue on the ballot for all of us to vote on, everyone in the state. Again, evidenced by what you're doing here today, a complete lie. Their goal was always to use a loophole in the Constitution to turn something into law, despite it being supported only by a small minority of our people. And those of you on the other side of the aisle are all too happy to be puppets in this offensive game impacting women's lives. The reality is, over the past couple of weeks, I've heard from nearly as many Republicans as I have Democrats, including many Republicans that even signed Right to Life's initiative, who are disgusted to find out you are subverting the democratic process to make this law. To claim something is a citizen's initiative, or that you're only acting on the will of the people, you have to be able to back that up. But you can't even come close. Not only are you trying to enact a law brought to us by only 4% of our population, but polling suggests only one-third of Michigan's entire population supports your plan.
That was Michigan State Senator Gretchen Widmer. This bill passed last night with a final vote of 27 to 11. The ACLU of Michigan says that this is a solution in search of a problem, and they believe people who signed petitions were lied to and told that the new insurance exchanges would use tax money to pay for abortions, which is not true. The debate in the legislature shows that it will affect women of all races and classes and could be interpreted to deny coverage for miscarriages. A similar bill passed last year, but was vetoed by Republican Governor Rick Snyder. This time, because it's a citizen initiative that brought the bill before lawmakers, he cannot veto the bill, and the bill will move forward into law.
A lawsuit filed today by the ACLU of Michigan challenges the decision of an employer to force a pregnant employee out of work. The employee, who works as a nurse in a medical facility, was told by her doctor not to lift heavy objects. This led her employer to claim that she could not work until that medical restriction was lifted. But the employer has a history of accommodating workers with similar restrictions, according to the lawsuit filed today. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with lead attorney Brooke Tucker about the lawsuit.
I'm speaking now with Brooke Tucker. She is an attorney with the ACLU of Michigan. Brooke, can you tell us about the lawsuit that the ACLU of Michigan has filed, arguing that a Michigan woman who's pregnant cannot be forced off the job?
Absolutely. Well, first, thank you so much for having me. The lawsuit that we filed today concerns a woman named Asia Myers, who, when she was only a few weeks pregnant, had a condition called threatened miscarriage, where she was experiencing bleeding and cramping related to her pregnancy. She immediately went to her doctor, who put her on a week of bed rest and then released her and said that she could go back to work as long as she didn't do any lifting or pushing. Ms. Myers works as a certified nursing aide at a home health care facility, and plenty of people who have these restrictions due to other injuries are given accommodations by this employer when they need it for a short duration. However, they refused to give a similar accommodation to Ms. Myers. Instead, they told her that she had to punch out and go home. And as a result, she was forced to remain unpaid without her health benefits for 30 days until her doctor released those restrictions. And what we're arguing with this lawsuit is that it is discriminatory for an employer to treat other employees with similar restrictions who are not pregnant different from pregnant employees.
Well, and it's ironic that she works herself in the healthcare field. Is this something that you've come across in other examples, either in the healthcare field or in other fields?
Usually this problem is very serious in professions that are largely dominated by women, such as nursing or home health care aides, things of that nature. And so that's why we're really hoping that this lawsuit will make employers aware that it is in fact discriminatory and that under the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act, as well as federal law, they are not allowed to do this.
And what are the laws that are in place that allow pregnant women to retain their jobs?
Well, there are two federal laws specifically that we are alleging the employer violated in this suit. One is Title VII, which also has a Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which says that you cannot treat non-pregnant employees differently from pregnant employees. And then there's also the Americans with Disabilities Act, which says that if you are disabled but nonetheless qualified to perform your job, the employer must provide you with a reasonable accommodation, so long as it doesn't impose an undue burden on the employer. And we know that since this employer routinely gives this accommodation to other non-pregnant employees, it would not have been burdensome for him to give it to our client. And then lastly, there's a state law that says pregnant workers who are similar in their ability to work as non-pregnant workers have to be treated the same. And so under each of these laws, the employer is in violation because they did not do that. Instead, they're treating non-pregnant workers who have the exact same restrictions as our client differently and allowing them to work, allowing them to retain their benefits while our client was forced to be at home.
What do you think it says about the state of women's rights in Michigan and in the U.S. when 35 years after the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was passed by the U.S. Congress, women are still having to fight these battles?
You know, I mean, this is part of a nationwide assault on women's health and women's rights. And, you know, it's very good that we were able to get the Pregnancy Discrimination Act passed 35 years ago. That was groundbreaking. But it shows us that there's still work to do in this area. And we're hoping that with this lawsuit, it's going to make a statement that we're not going to sit by and let pregnant women be discriminated against in the state of Michigan.
Well, I do want to thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Brooke Tucker, she is with the ACLU of Michigan, who is part of a lawsuit arguing that a pregnant woman cannot be forced off the job simply because she's pregnant. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A grassroots organization in Kalamazoo, Michigan, recently discovered the use of toxic chemicals in the cleanup of a 2010 tar sands oil spill. In August of this year, the Michigan Coalition Against Tar Sands, or MyCATS, in conjunction with other local grassroots organizations, discovered the presence of toxic chemicals in the Kalamazoo River. The chemicals found shared the chemical signatures of oil dispersants used to break up oil into unrecoverable particles. The Kalamazoo Corporation, Enbridge Energy, who is responsible for the spill, along with the Environmental Protection Agency, denied the use of oil dispersants in the cleanup. Earlier this year, Chris Womhoff, a member of the Michigan Coalition Against Tar Sands, protested Enbridge Energy by skateboarding into their pipeline and halting construction. He currently faces 2 years in prison after being charged with resisting arrest and obstructing an officer. KBOO's Stephen Sherritt spoke with Mr. Womhoff today.
In August, following your protest in June, chemical oil dispersants were found in the Kalamazoo River. Could you talk more about the chemicals that were found and the effects that have been seen as a result of their presence in the river?
I want to make sure to put this out that the only reason that we know that these exist is because of Greg Ritter and the folks at Great Lakes Dilbit Defenders, which is another local grassroots org. They found these and kind of cued us in, and we started finding these formations which seem to have different variations of core exit, which is a chemical dispersant. Some of the forms of core exit we've been finding, at least three of them that we've found, are core exit 9527, core exit 9727A, and core exit 9500, which are all variations of this chemical dispersant. And unfortunately, these chemical dispersants, core exit, often come with something that's called a polyaromatic hydrocarbon. It's part of the dispersant makeup, and it's known for greatly multiplying bacteria around it. In cases in the BP spill, Vibrio, a flesh-eating disease, was shown to have 10 times the amount of this bacteria around these PAHs, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which are part of the core exit. We don't have that testing for sure as to what level those are at here, but that's it's certainly something that's really alarming. And it's also in response to September 30th, 2013, our Michigan Department of Community Health released a report saying that the Kalamazoo River was safe for recreational use. Unfortunately, they don't seem to account for the core exit formations in the river.
Are the chemical oil dispersants, were they used to clean up the oil spill, but also to separate the oil from the sand?
They're used to trap the oil. Now, bitumen tar sands sinks significantly fast. It sinks within 24 hours, even in salt water. So it still sinks significantly fast, especially in fresh water. However, Enbridge gets fined for all the oil that gets brought out of the Kalamazoo River. So what we believe they used the core exit for was to coagulate the oil. It traps it and helps it sink. It kind of like captures it and weighs it down, just like cement shoes for oil. And so if it goes and it sinks to the bottom, it forms with the bed. You look at the early reports, all the reports were that it was a crude oil, not that it was a bitumen tar sand oil leak. So we believe the Enbridge was using it to kind of try to hide their tracks and hide the imprint of how much oil actually went into the river. Eyewitnesses said that they seen dump trucks just dumping this stuff, but we can't find it where it's acknowledged that they used these dispersants in the cleanup.
Protesters in Portland are currently protesting mega loads, and residents in Alberta are also protesting tar sands. Are there any avenues that would allow activists like you and individuals in Portland and Alberta to connect on these issues?
We want this so much. We certainly, we read about the things that have been happening up in Canada, what the First Nations have been doing and what you guys have been doing with the Megaload, what Tar Sands Blockade was doing down there. And certainly, we're all kind of fighting the same battle. And I know it's been being talked about in our circles, how do we all network and how do we all work together? And I know, I don't know how we do that, but I certainly, I want to reach out. And very inspired, one of my heroes is Tim DeChristopher, and he kind of speaks about the movement, this movement being a movement where we start holding each other. And I definitely, for the time left that I have for sure before trial, want to see how we talk about that and how we get tar sands groups and beyond that, even nuclear groups and just environmentalism for what the impacts of climate change that we face, how we start all empowering each other and kind of holding each other and supporting each other to start making significant change. I've read reports that show and studies that show if you can get 3.5% of your country to rally around something at the same time. Here in the U.S., that would be 11 million people. There's a 100% success rate with peaceful revolution. And so my hope is that we definitely start coming together and figuring out how to communicate with each other, how to coordinate actions together, and start seeing how we get 11 million people on the same page to get some changes for some very big challenges we have ahead of us.
That was Chris Womhoff of the Michigan Coalition Against Tar Sands and KBOO PM News' Stephen Sherritt.
According to Yemeni officials, a U.S. drone reportedly killed 13 people traveling with a wedding party on their way to a village outside the city of Rada, capital of Yemen's Baida province. The strike left charred bodies in the burning vehicles and on the road. The officials spoke with a condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to brief the media. One official claimed Al-Qaeda fighters were suspected to be among the party, but another said that the wedding party was mistaken for an Al-Qaeda convoy. Yemen's Al-Qaeda branch is considered by the U.S. to be one of the most active in the world, with Rada being a major stronghold. The Central Intelligence Agency has so far declined to comment on the strike.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, James Dobbins, the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, says that the U.S. is, quote, nowhere near a decision to pull out all troops by the end of 2014. This is despite Afghan President Hamid Karzai having not yet signed a deal that would allow U.S. troop presence past that time. The deal was brokered earlier this year and endorsed by a tribal council of elders, but Karzai then introduced new demands, prompting the U.S. to declare it would pull out all 47,000 of its troops. The lack of U.S. and U.N. presence in the country would likely discourage donors from sending military and civilian aid to Afghanistan. Ambassador Dobbins says, however, that he is confident Karzai will eventually sign the bill.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, December 12, 2013. Israel drops a controversial plan to displace tens of thousands of Palestinians from their villages, and a Palestinian youth die of wounds sustained 9 years ago. The details are coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli government has decided on Thursday to drop the current draft of a bill to displace nearly 30,000 Palestinian Bedouins living in the Negev, known as the Prather Plan. The plan was proposed by former Israeli Minister of Planning Ehud Braver in 2011 and was approved by the Israeli Parliament in June 2013. Benny Begin, an architect of the Begin-Braver plan, told the press conference that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has accepted his recommendation to halt progress on the bill. Some observers have voiced concerns whether the bill has been shelved or just temporarily postponed. The Braver plan has triggered anger among Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and also in Israel. Talab Sana, a Palestinian member of the Israeli parliament, said, quote, "We have made it clear repeatedly that our people will not allow another catastrophe or Nakba, and all plans that aim at displacing us from our land will fail," unquote. He added that the latest government decision is a victory to the popular struggle against this plan, which was held in all Arab cities and towns in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Most of these Bedouins live in villages that are not recognized by the Israeli government. They do not receive services from the Israeli government. In other news, a young Palestinian man died on Thursday morning of a serious injury suffered after being shot by an Israeli soldier in 2004, which put him in a wheelchair. Farid al-Atrash, a lawyer and activist, said that his brother Mu'in al-Atrash, 29, from the Hisha refugee camp, fell into coma 6 days ago due to serious complications. A month ago, he was moved to the Arab Rehabilitation Society in Bethlehem and was later moved to the Al-Maqasid Hospital in Jerusalem due to the severity of his condition. He suffered serious complications, including serious pressure sores, which eventually led to his death despite extensive efforts to provide him with the needed medical attention. In 2004, Mu'in al-Atrash was shot by an Israeli army bullet to the back, hitting his spine and causing paralysis. He was shot during one of the massive protests in different parts of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip after an Israeli warplane fired a missile at the wheelchair-bound spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, in Gaza on March 22, 2004. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, December 12, 2013 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please keep visiting our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Ghassan Bannoura and me, George Rishmawi.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Stephen Sherritt, Christian Danielson, Barbara Nelson, Jimmy Tardy, Joe Meyer, Paul Rowland, and Christian Yount. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our excellent engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers. So if you have a pen or something to write with, the local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, Ani and Lynn talk with mythologist, author, and storyteller Michael Mead about his essay, Gratitude and the Gift of Life. At 9, host Joe Uris interviews filmmaker and former Portlander Penny Allen about her new feature, Late for My Mother's Funeral, and about European and North African politics. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on the Digital Divide, host Rabia Yeaman speaks with Kelly Roy and Seamus Holly, the director and shopmaster, respectively, at ADX, where high-profile designers work alongside students and retirees and share their knowledge. Thanks to KABU members out there for supporting KABU Community Radio. If you are not a member, you can become one right this instant, if you'd like, by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for feature story news. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Jen.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Mixed Signals, we hear from South Africa as the man at the centre of the fake sign language fiasco at Nelson Mandela's memorial finally speaks out.
We know that this individual had a number of incidents during his tenure as an interpreter at the court. There's documentary evidence articulating and documenting a number of alleged incidents of violence.
Also today we have the very latest on the House vote on the US budget deal, and we learn why a ruling by India's Supreme Court has outraged the country's homosexual community.
I mean, I think there's definitely a lot of marginalization of the gay community and the transgender community. Constitutional and a legal standpoint, we need to protect them much more than what we do right now.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Murray-Potts. Bangladesh has executed a top Islamist leader, Abdul Qadar Mullah, in the country's first conviction under its International Crimes Tribunal. The tribunal was set up in 2010 to investigate atrocities committed during the 1971 War of Independence with Pakistan. Mullah was a senior figure in the Jamaat-e-Islami party. His trial sparked protests earlier this year. His execution appeared to have been rushed through following a heated legal debate over his conviction. Political analysts have warned his execution could trigger more protests, further dividing the country, but others have applauded the decision, calling it historic. The White House says President Obama expressed no concerns about his security in South Africa. A spokesman was reacting to reports from South Africa that a sign language interpreter at Nelson Mandela's memorial service has a history of mental illness and violence. From Washington, Simon Marks reports.
For the White House, the question about this week's events in South Africa are mounting. How could President Obama have stood so close to a sign language interpreter now facing questions about his qualifications and his struggle with mental illness? A White House spokesman said he couldn't comment on specific security preparations made ahead of Tuesday's memorial, but he tried to assure reporters that the Secret Service goes to great efforts to protect the president. However, he was surrounded by a crowd that had not been security screened and flanked by an interpreter with violent incidents in his past. The questions for South African authorities are growing. Simon Marks, Washington.
A spokesman for Syria's main Western-backed rebel group has described a decision by the US and UK to suspend non-lethal aid to opposition fighters in the north of the country as impulsive and hasty. Lorna Shaddock reports.
Louis al-Mikdad, a spokesman for the Free Syrian Army, said the group is in contact with British and American authorities, asking them to reconsider what it's called a hasty decision. On Wednesday, Washington and London stopped all non-lethal aid to northern Syria, including communication equipment, trucks, food and medical supplies. The decision came a few days after Islamist factions took control of FSA bases and warehouses at the Bab al-Halwa crossing near the border with Turkey and seized supplies there intended for moderate fighters. The FSA's secular Western-backed leader, General Salim Idris, was forced to flee the country during the takeover. The episode illustrates two growing problems faced by Western powers in Syria, the rising military dominance of Islamist groups, and the continued splintering of the already fractured opposition. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych still intends to sign a deal on closer EU ties, according to the bloc's foreign policy chief. Catherine Ashton has been speaking in Brussels after meeting pro-EU protesters who have brought the centre of the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, to a standstill. Demonstrators have been on the streets of Kiev since President Yanukovych backed away from an EU association agreement after pressure from Moscow. But Baroness Ashton says he has given her the impression he will eventually sign it.
Look, Yanukovych made it clear to me that he intends to sign the association agreement. What he talked about were the short-term economic issues that the country faces. And it is my view that those challenges, which are real, can be addressed by the support that not only comes from the European Union institutions, but actually by showing that he has a serious economic plan in signing the association agreement, also will help to bring in the kind of investment that he needs.
Australia's High Court has struck down the Australian Capital Territory's same-sex marriage laws. Arthur Stevens reports.
The ACT enacted its same-sex marriage legislation in November, with the first couples marrying last weekend. In that time, about 30 couples have tied the knot. In its decision on Thursday, the High Court held that only Australia's federal parliament had the power under the Australian Constitution to legislate for same-sex marriage. Supporters of gay marriage are dismayed at the ruling, with Australian Marriage Equality National Director Rodney Croom saying the ruling is devastating for couples who married this week. Western Australian State Upper House Parliamentarian Stephen Dawson, who married his partner in Canberra last Saturday, called the court decision disappointing. Meanwhile, the Australian Christian Lobby has applauded the High Court ruling. I'm Arthur Stevens, Melbourne.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The man at the centre of the fake sign language interpretation at Nelson Mandela's memorial service has spoken out. Tamsankar Jantji has spoken to the world's media and has claimed his heavily criticised interpretation was due to mental illness, specifically schizophrenia. Karen Morn, a journalist with E-News Channel Africa in Johannesburg, had the chance to speak with him earlier.
He has given a number of different responses to various publications. I know that in newspapers in Johannesburg, he simply said that, he apologized for what happened. He said that he'd been overcome. When I spoke to him, he said he'd had a moment of sort of schizophrenic outburst, that he'd been overcome by happiness, and that he had temporarily lost the ability to sign. Subsequently in the interview, however, he said that he in fact had done a definitively good job and that anyone who wanted to criticize him should tell the world who should have replaced him. So he's been extremely erratic. And I have to say that in my dealings with him, and I was at his home for over an hour this morning, it's become very apparent that this is a person with quite a profound psychiatric disorder. His wife, at one stage, I asked if I could see his medication. She brought out a large plastic bag filled with quite high dosage psychiatric medications, including Epilim, which he apparently takes four or five pills a day. And it became very obvious that his responses would deviate according to where he was emotionally. So we have seen him apologize. We've also seen him being very defensive. We've seen him attack his accusers. And in an interview with me, he actually stated that he felt that
you know, at one point during the Mandela proceedings, his life was in danger because, quote, there was such tight security there. And he said, I could feel myself becoming sick, and I'm actually quite proud of myself that no mistake was made. Now, given that he has admitted that he suffered from violent outbursts as a result of his illness, we can read into that comment whatever we may.
His claims of suffering from violent outbursts, as you just put it, does this set off alarm bells for South African authorities who allowed this man within such close proximity to world leaders?
We know that this individual had a number of incidents during his tenure as an interpreter at the court. We know that there's documentary evidence from staff at the Boksburg magistrate in Johannesburg articulating and documenting a number of alleged incidents of violence, of threats. We know, for instance, that he allegedly at one point held a fellow co-worker, a senior, a superior, hostage with a brick. Other interpreters in the court building hid themselves in their cars. The woman in question says she is not prepared to talk about it without the permission of the Justice Department, but the Justice Department is fully aware of this. We know, having spoken to senior justice personnel, that in fact, what is this, the court staff has provided the Justice Department with copies of all his her correspondence dating back several years ago about Mr. Janki, which she resent them this morning as part of a wider governmental investigation. So certainly, from the people that I've spoken to, from some of the other staff interpreters at that court, they actually said that they were terrified of him, that his behavior was erratic, and that they really feared that he could harm either himself or themselves. So there has been documentary evidence of this. The Department of Justice not responding on the record about that at this stage. They have responded off the record to confirm that they are aware that this individual was investigated by that department for a 1.5 million rand fraud in which he was alleged to have made multiple false claims for interpretation to the department. But at this stage, they cannot say what happened to that investigation. So I think at this point, really, it's reached the stage where if government doesn't come out, do a proper investigation, explain itself, explain its processes, and explain where the gaps happened, I think any high-ranking politician would be loath to set foot in this country and participate in these kind of events for fear of the kind of people that are clearly being allowed access to them.
It's important to point out that this is an offshoot of the bigger story, which is, of course, the passing of Nelson Mandela. And people in South Africa are still mourning, are still paying their tributes. And we saw thousands queue to catch a glimpse of Nelson Mandela's body.
Well, I was up at about 4 o'clock this morning because I couldn't sleep. And people were tweeting at me from those queues, asking me where the buses would come. These are people, I mean, we must remember that the South African government has chosen not to provide public holidays for people to go and view Nelson Mandela lying in state. These are people who have taken days off, who have brought their families, who have brought their children, who have stood in long lines, uncomplainingly in most cases, to spend 2 or 3 seconds with Nelson Mandela. And the kind of range of emotion is intense because you see people in a very kind of a supportive and friendly atmosphere in the moments leading up to the point where they see his body. And then after this, just this intense emotion, the silence. The silence is quite profound because I think on a visceral level, when people register that this great man's spirit has departed the earth, it becomes very real just how much we have lost. And I think the kind of reactions that we're seeing from people in those moments after that realization is made are quite profound.
Karen Morn, journalist with eNews Channel Africa in Johannesburg.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
The This Friday, on Positively Revolting, our guest will be renowned mythologist, psychologist, author, and storyteller Michael Mead. We'll be discussing Michael's essay, Gratitude and the Gift of Life, Insights into the Holiday Season. So if you are interested in understanding soul and connection in the midst of consumer insanity, tune in Friday, December 13th, from 8 to 9 a.m. on KBOO, your community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 19th year of the Portland Revels. The Portland Revels will perform 11 shows between December 6th and December 15th. That's the Portland Revels, December 6th to the 15th at the Scottish Rite Center in downtown Portland. More information about the show can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders, featuring the stories and songs of elders from the Native nations who lived and still live along the Lewis and Clark Trail. I'm Arlie Neskai of the Dene Nation. In the next hour, we'll feature the Confederated Tribes of the Cayuse, Walla Walla, and Umatilla Indians. We'll take a tour of the Salmon Nation and learn about the Owl Dance and other power favorites. We'll pump it up with a couple of enthusiastic women in their fight against diabetes. And we'll meet Thomas Morning Owl, a Umatilla artist. Then we'll witness the healing power of dreams. But first, we'll hear from Cayuse elder Kathleen Gordon.
She tried to follow the ways she learned about the Creator and how the Creator wanted human beings to live.
This is Wisdom of the Elders. Stay with us. This is Najuan performing Red from the album Brother on the Heading North music label.
Look into your conscience for the faces of people. Are they full of anger, pain and fear? But last you walked unbowed, and you can't take that away from me.